Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCrary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, I'm talking with legendary Republican pollster Whit Ayers, founder and president of North Star Opinion Research. His political roots largely originate in South Carolina politics, and he starts his own polling firm in the mid-80s and has subsequently built a client list that includes big Republican names like Bill Frist, Strom Thurmond, Lamar Alexander, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, Ron DeSantis, among many more. In this conversation, we talk through Whit's path to politics, some of his most prominent clients, stories from his favorite campaigns, thoughts on the evolution of the Republican Party, and much more. Whit Ayers, tell me a bit how you grew up.
I grew up in Ames, Iowa, a caucus state, if ever there was one, but I grew up there before there was a caucus. I went to Ames High School. My dad was an engineering professor at Iowa State University, so I grew up in an academic town. I went to Ames High School, which was as competitive as any college that I ended up at. It was a good experience, good Midwestern upbringing, wonderful people, lousy weather.
And is that a political family at all? Was politics something that was front and center in the Ayers household?
No, it's kind of amazing. There was no one in my family that was the least bit interested in politics. I got turned on to it in an 11th grade government class. Mr. Enquist really turned me on to government and politics, and it has stuck with me the rest of my life. It's a good testimony to the effect that a really good teacher can have on a student for decades to come.
And was it a campaign or a cause or a candidate that got your attention?
It was more the process and how democracy worked and how totalitarianism worked. When I was in college or immediately after college, I took a tour of Europe with my Dutch roommate and went through the Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin. It was quite an experience, my first contact with a totalitarian regime. We took the train to go from West Germany into Berlin, which is in the heart of East Germany, and they stopped the train outside of the Berlin station, and these tough-looking guys with their German shepherd dogs got on the train and looked at my passport in a way I had never, ever seen it look before. It's a frightening experience. You go through Checkpoint Charlie, and they are running mirrors under buses to make sure that no one is trying to sneak out of this nirvana of East Berlin. And it was a searing experience for me that you really realize when you spend time in a totalitarian regime just how different it is. It's really, really repressive. And so I think right then I sort of became have a real interest in democracy and the functioning of democracy and freedom of speech and freedom of religion and all the freedoms that we enjoy here today that totalitarian regimes like Russia tend to do a pretty good job of totally squashing.
So that's some initial impressions internationally. And then how does that map onto the domestic scene for you? How do you interpret what you're seeing?
It's really drove home to me the critical importance of free expression, of free elections, the kind of stuff that you and I do for a living every day in helping people get elected. I'd always had sort of center-right inclinations. The Ronald Reagan administration sort of drove that home to me that you could be a center-right candidate and make a difference with government, have a positive effect on people's lives, as well as the world.
Grew up in Iowa. You talk about this seminal experience overseas, but looking at your resume, seems like your political roots are really North Carolina, South Carolina. Is that right? What is the story there? How do you get there? And is that indeed where you see that your political roots start to find soil?
Well, my parents were Southern. My dad was from Mississippi, my mother from Virginia. All of my roots are in the South. And so I ended up going to Davidson College in North Carolina, the college that Steph Curry made famous. It was at the time an all-boys school, not my best call, actually. It went co-ed the year after I graduated, majored in political science, and had some very good poli-sci profs. I went from there to teach eighth grade in Greenville, South Carolina, which is my first experience in South Carolina. Taught 150 different eighth graders every day on American history and South Carolina history and civics. And it was the toughest job I've ever had in my life, much tougher than running a political campaign. 150 screaming eighth graders in the course of a day, five classes of 30 kids each. By Friday, I was utterly exhausted. I'd go home, draw a tub, crack a beer, and sit there and listen to the silence. It was an experience, but I really enjoyed it. It took all the energy I had. It was the most exhausting job I've ever had. And I still, to this day, hear from some of my former eighth grade students. Just this last week, I got an email from one who remembered half the kids in our class, which was pretty amazing. I went to graduate school at University of North Carolina, got a master's and doctorate there. I left North Carolina in 1979 after 4 years there, getting my doctorate, and went to University of South Carolina to teach government and international studies on the faculty there. So I bounced around between North and South Carolina for a number of years.
And looking at the political landscape, am I right that either your first or one of your first forays into more active participation politically is with former Republican South Carolina Governor Carol Campbell? What is the connection there? And is that indeed what pulled you into the more active political fray?
It was. I had been interested in getting some Washington experience, so I applied for an American Political Science Association Congressional Fellowship, got the fellowship, worked on the House side for then Congresswoman Carol Campbell, and on the Senate side for Senator Richard Lugar. Both very impressive men, both kind of center-right, governing-oriented Republicans, both very successful in their own way. Richard Lugar was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he was flying all over the world. This was a time when Ronald Reagan was president, and he was almost a proxy for the president in many of his trips around the world. With Carol Campbell, I did a lot of policy research, did some polling for him, and then he came back and ran for governor of South Carolina. I did polling for him. This was 1986. And after he won, he invited me to join his administration. I became a budget and policy director for him and got a taste of what real practical politics was like. Decided I'd like that better than the academic version, and I never left.
What is the story of how the career you've described to that point, and largely an academic setting, how does that translate into you doing polling for a sitting member of Congress? That's a model that I suspect would not replicate itself today for the most part.
Well, as a matter of fact, Dick Riley, the governor in South Carolina in 1982, got me into it. I was making my massive $14,000 a year salary as an assistant professor, and they were going to give us a 2% pay raise. And in order to balance the budget, they vetoed my pay raise. And so I was sitting there trying to figure out what could I do that would actually get some additional money in addition to this massive professor's salary. And I realized that I knew the methodology of polling from my graduate degrees. And so I trotted on down to the campaign manager's office and the local congressman. The congressman was a guy named Floyd Spence, and the campaign manager was a young man named Joe Wilson, who later became rather famous during a Barack Obama State of the Union address. Anyway, Joe took a chance on me, and this was back in the days of mainframe computers, and hired students to do calls for the congressional race, used the mainframe computer to run the data. The numbers are right on the money. I thought, this is kind of fun. I kind of enjoy this. So I sort of did polling on the side a few years until I went to Washington, and then continued to do it for Carol Campbell.
And give some background on Carol Campbell, a defining Republican governor of the era very successful in state at a time when Democrats were still very competitive in statewide elections. So give a bit of the thumbnail profile of Carroll Campbell, the political figure.
He was a very, very bright man, always gave every decision two scrubs. One was obviously, what effect does this have on me politically? But the other was, is this going to be good for the state? And he was very sincere with both of those. It really taught me a lot on how you can be a successful politician, but also do good things for the state while you're in office. He taught me a lot about what a governor can do. I'm a big fan of governors because you can actually get something done as opposed to coming up to Washington and giving speeches and nothing ever happens. One brief example, I taught public school and I was trying to figure out how to get some better teachers in public schools because the women who had in the past taught AP science courses and been such incredible teachers were now off becoming lawyers and doctors and businesswomen. I thought about my own personal experience where I'd gone for 3 years to teach public school and then go on to something else. And I thought maybe we can lure some people into teaching who are really capable people, but who aren't going to teach for 30 or 40 years. And so I took this idea to the governor and said, why don't we have a governor's teaching scholarship, kind of like an ROTC scholarship, where you can commit to a year of teaching in South Carolina public schools, and we'll pay for a year of your college. And if you'll pay, commit to 4 years of teaching, we'll pay for 4 years of your college. You had to have a B average, you had to have a 1200 SAT score. And he thought, that was a great idea. So the legislature funded it. Before you know it, we had teachers in the classroom with very, very good credentials, who are going to be there for 3 or 4 years before they went on to law school or med school or whatever they're going to do. And it was a good lesson for me how a governor can have an effect on things and make things happen that many other elected officials are not able to do.
And Carroll Campbell had health problems that led to him passing away at a young age, but very telegenic, left office after 2 terms with job approvals at 70% plus. If he would not have had some of this tragic fate befall him, is he someone who you think ultimately would have run for president or otherwise been a national leader in the subsequent decades?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, we sort of had him on track. He was widely mentioned as a possible vice presidential pick for Bob Dole in 1996. Carroll Campbell and Lamar Alexander together defined the successful Southern Republican governor, the ones that went into office to make a difference. They were very good at what they did. They both became very popular. And of course, as we know, Lamar Alexander did run for president in 1996 and in 2000. Clearly, Carroll Campbell would have been on that national track, but he was struck at a very early age, at 61, with early onset Alzheimer's. And I tell you, Zach, you don't wish that on your worst enemy. He's one of the smartest people I've ever known. He could take an idea that you had and twist it about 15 degrees one way or the other, and it would be a better idea in a way that you'd never thought of. But with that early onset Alzheimer's, his brain just went downhill incredibly fast, and he was gone 3 or 4 years later. It was a real tragedy. I mean, he finally died at age 65, but he clearly would have been a very, very fine national leader, I think, and would probably have run for president someday if this hadn't befallen him.
Carroll Campbell then is really a catalyst, the catalyst. But mechanically, how do you make a jump into polling full time? Jump into the political consulting fray full time? Just mechanically, logistically, what does that look like? What all went into that decision and that process?
Well, it's like jumping off a very high cliff without a parachute. My then wife was living in Atlanta. We had had a commuting marriage for 10 years and decided if we were ever going to have kids, one of us was going to have to create a job in the other one's cities. So I left Columbia, South Carolina as the budget director to the governor and went to Atlanta to start a polling firm. Kind of a transition. I had been the budget director for a governor who could call up an agency head and get them on the phone immediately, or if not immediately, they'd call me back in 5 minutes because they thought I had some control over their budget to go to Atlanta. And I'd say, call up people and say, I'm Whit Ayers. And they go, who? And why are you bothering me? Quite a transition to go from a senior staffer to the governor to somebody who nobody ever heard of sitting in the basement of your house trying to get a polling firm going. A young woman showed up at my door as a temp. Cheryl Glenn decided she would be willing to come help me. And so she came down to the basement and she'd help me make phone calls and that sort of thing. We are now some 33 years after that, and she is still my administrative assistant, working with us today. It was a very fortunate connection that we made back then. But I was really fortunate to land first major Republican Senate candidate, Paul Coverdell, right after I moved to Atlanta. Paul was a great man, a great American, a great Republican. He was running against Weitch Fowler, whom you may remember in 1992. A sort of center-left Democratic senator. Paul managed to win four races that year on the way to getting his Senate seat. He came in first in a runoff for the Republican nomination against Bob Barr, who later became a congressman, and then had to win a runoff by one percentage point. And then he was running against Weitch Fowler when nobody gave him an ice cube's chance in hell to win. It was a lot of fun working on it, but we didn't have any money because nobody thought he could win. And then we ended up having a little old lady who wrote a jingle and sent it in to Paul and said, you really need to run this jingle. You know, I think it'd really help you. And so we did this ad with this little old lady sitting in a swing, singing, let's put Paul Coverdell in the Senate and put Weitch Fowler out.
Let's put Paul Coverdell in the Senate and put Weitch Fowler out. Weitch has proved we don't need him in it and Georgia wants him out. But with Paul Coverdell, we'll have a leader of that. There is no doubt. So vote Paul Coverdell in the Senate and put Weitch Fowler out. Now, Paul needs a catchy jingle, so y'all use that. We've got to get rid of Weitch Fowler. He's just like Ted Kennedy.
So vote Paul Coverdell in the Senate and put Weitch Fowler out. We got to get rid of Weitch Fowler. He's just like Ted Kennedy. And we put that on the air and our donors went ballistic. Absolutely ballistic. It's like, I gave you money to tell why Weitch Fowler was this liberal guy that we needed to get rid of, and you put some little old lady on a swing singing a ditty, and they were going nuts. But then in the polling, in the verbatim responses, we started seeing these things like, I'm a teacher. I hate that thing because that gets in my head, but my kids come in and singing that tune every day. It was like, well, maybe we got something here. It became such a phenomenon that poor Weitch Fowler ended up doing an ad with his grandmother to show that, yes, he could be popular with old ladies too. And that sort of put Paul on the map. He ended up actually losing to Weitch in the general election by 1 point. It was 49-48. But that was in an era, as we still have, with a runoff if you don't get to 50%. And so we went into a runoff 3 weeks later, 2 days before Thanksgiving in 1992, Bill Clinton had just won the election. Bill Clinton came down to Macon and did a big rally for Weitch Fowler. But we ended up pulling that out by one percentage point again in the runoff. But that's what really put us on the map. The entire eyes of the world were on Georgia for that three-week period. The entire National Republican Senatorial Committee decamped to Atlanta. That's where I first met Mike Murphy, the incredibly entertaining media guy. And that's put us on the map. It was a really fortunate get for me and for our firm. We ended up doing then Bill Frist in 1994 in Tennessee with a huge upset. And we were off to the races. It was a long, lonely time there for a while, sitting in our basement before we got this going. But I was very fortunate then in 1995, a young man from Georgia, from the Poli Sci department came in named John McHenry and said, I'd like to work with you for a while. And so I said, yeah, sure, you can, be an intern here. 29 years later, he's still there. And then in 2001, another guy from Georgia came in and said, I'd like to work with you guys a little bit. His name was Dan Judy. He's the new kid. He's only been with us now for 23 years. The four of us have stayed together for a long, long time, helping to get good, solid governing Republicans elected.
Well, that's a great look at the trajectory of what was initially what Ayers McHenry, now is North Star Opinion Research. Over the years, and maybe this is more germane in your first few years, were you intentionally playing up your academic credentials? Was it Dr. Ayers? Or were you trying to avoid being pigeonholed as some sort of academic elitist egghead?
Well, it really didn't do a whole lot for you to go in as, the former professor. Sometimes people would play on that. And I do think it gave me some credibility. Having a doctorate in political science gives some credibility that you know what you're doing. But far more important than that is being a part of teams that win races that you were not supposed to win. Having a reputation as the firm that would work with you to win races that no one thought you could win was far more important than the doctorate or Dr. Ayers or Professor Ayers.
You've mentioned a couple of them already. Let me ask about a few of the other candidates you worked with. If you could speak to what made them successful political figures or your own insight into their careers, a name that's already come up briefly, but let me start with Lamar Alexander. I believe you worked with him as far back as the aforementioned presidential campaign in 1996, someone who was a governor, a senator, a cabinet secretary, a university president. What made Lamar Alexander successful across the decades in politics?
Lamar Alexander was very, very good at identifying certain needs and communicating them clearly. Very good sense of how to give concise ways to communicate what he wanted to do. Cleaner air, better schools, more jobs. And once he got to the Senate, he became a critical component for Mitch McConnell, for example, in framing in a very clear way what the party or what he was trying to do. He was a very successful governor of Tennessee. As you mentioned, became president of the University of Tennessee before George Bush got him to be education secretary, and then became a very successful, very influential senator. He's a guy who has made a difference wherever he was his entire life. He also was pretty ambitious and wasn't scared to take on a very, very difficult race, much like Paul Coverdale and Bill Frist were. I remember he was running for the Republican nomination against Bob Dole, 1996. The first survey I did for him in Iowa among Iowa caucus goers, Dole was at 54 and he was at 3. The way Lamar tells the story, I came in and told him that he was behind 54-3, but the margin of error was ±4, so he really could be at 0. Now, I don't call it exactly that same way, but that's the way it has gone into Lamar Alexander lore. But he has a very keen sense of things that need doing to make life better. For example, when he was a senator, he was very active in getting musicians to get more credit for their performances and for their recordings when the streaming era came along. Obviously, the country music industry is really, really big in Tennessee. So he's always looked around and found things that he thought needed doing, then figuring out a way to get them done and make them happen. He had a tone about him that was not at all consistent with the current tone of our politics. He loved to quote Alex Haley, the author of Roots, find the good and praise it. And that was very much his motto. Even in dealing with Donald Trump, plenty of things to criticize about Donald Trump, but he got along well with Donald Trump because he would find something that Donald Trump did that he thought was worthy and he would praise it. And so that was his mantra, literally his entire career and still is to this day.
In that 96 presidential campaign you were part of, one of the rifts Alexander had was ABC. Alexander beats Clinton. He ran a strong, somewhat insurgent campaign that year against the frontrunner Bob Dole, despite, as you lay out, starting way back in the pack, but was at times was just a few points here or there if the race breaks a little differently from potentially stealing that nomination from Dole. If somehow Alexander wrests the nomination away from Bob Dole in 1996, what do you think a Clinton versus Alexander 96 race looks like? Two New South governors running against each other in that 1996 Clinton reelection.
I think it would have been a hell of a race. I think it would have been really close. He would certainly have run much stronger than Bob Dole ran.
Dole, of course, ends up losing by 9-10 points in an electoral college landslide.
Exactly. He would have made it really close. Bill Clinton is an incredible politician. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. I don't know if we could actually have won, but it would have been close, and he would have had a very, very good shot at it. And I don't think there's any question that the Clinton people were far more scared of Lamar Alexander than they were of Bob Dole.
And in that race, I guess this was a throwback to some of his time in Tennessee, his gubernatorial campaigns, but he adopted the plaid work shirt, plaid shirt in that 96 campaign. And maybe
I've still got mine in my closet, Zach.
Clearly, that was not something that you put in a poll, agree or disagree, he should wear a plaid shirt. But tell the story of the plaid shirt through the political prism of Lamar Alexander.
Well, the plaid shirt actually predated me. He started wearing the plaid shirt on a walk across Tennessee. He and his top advisor, Tom Ingram, were trying to figure out what is there that we can do that would capture attention. They decided they would walk across the length of Tennessee, which, by the way, is so long east to west, it's basically a quarter of the way across the country. And so he put on the plaid shirt as sort of a branding thing and walked across Tennessee and started getting a lot of attention. You know, Lamar Alexander's coming into town, and he would stay with local people. He wouldn't stay in a hotel. And it was part of the Lamar Alexander brand that stuck with him throughout his entire career. I wish I could take credit for it, but I'm afraid that occurred before I came along, but they stuck with it. And it has to this day been associated with Lamar.
A figure with a complicated political past is Strom Thurmond, who'd been in office well before you were born, going back to the 40s, part of the segregationist effort in the South in that era. He serves in the U.S. Senate from South Carolina into the 21st century, softens on some of those issues, though still remains pretty stridently conservative, virtually all of the cultural issues throughout his career. But you were all over South Carolina politics in the 80s and 90s, including his last U.S. Senate reelection in 96, when he, I guess, was in his 90s, which was a competitive race. Democrats had a credible opponent in that 96 race, his last reelection. Do you have a go-to Strom Thurmond story, something you can impart about a very important historical figure?
Everybody who has ever worked with Strom Thurmond has a Strom Thurmond story. I did a survey for him when he was 94 years old and talking about running for re-election yet again. And I did the survey, and I went up and sat down in his big office in Russell Senate office building and said, "Senator, the people of South Carolina think three things about you. Number one, they revere the job you've done over these many years. Number two, they still approve of the job you're doing." And he leaned across the desk and said, "And number three, they don't want me to run again, do they?" I said, "Bingo, Senator, you got it." He leans in, he says, "Son, you listen and you listen good. I am going to run and I am going to win." And he did, and he did. One of the toughest negative ads I've ever seen, not because it was mean, but it was just very effective, was a bunch of elderly people sitting around in a rocking chair outside of an old folks home. And the money line was, "Strom, we love you, but it's time to come on home." That was tough. But he started off at 54%. He ended up at 54%. It was one of the best run campaigns I've ever been a part of, because while he didn't move a single additional voter, he didn't lose any. And when you're 94 years old, that's pretty tough. One of the things I learned from Strom Thurmond was his amazing constituency service. it was very hard to find a person in South Carolina who'd lived there for any length of time who had not been touched by Strom Thurmond. And I remember the first organizational meeting we had. I looked out, a quarter of the room consisted of Black people who wanted to help Strom Thurmond. I was like, wait. This is a Dixiecrat guy, right? And what I didn't sufficiently appreciate was that once the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, Strom Thurmond basically said, listen, they're my constituents too, and they vote just like the white people do. He started supporting National Black College Week. He was very active in engaging with any Black constituents who had a problem with Social Security or any other problem with the federal government. All of those Black folks who were out there were people who had been touched in some way by Strom Thurmond. He is not anywhere near as conservative as his reputation. Let's just put it that way.
South Carolina now very much a red state, but we're talking about the 96 re-election 2 years later in 1998. South Carolina elects a Democratic governor and re-elects a Democratic U.S. senator. So still a state where Democrats are winning. It was a competitive race that you described and could have gotten even tighter. What percentage were you finding Thurmond's job approval or the vote he received on Election Day among Black voters? Do you have a ballpark figure?
It was somewhere around 25%. It was a stunningly high number compared to his reputation. And it's exactly because of what I just said. Very, very intense constituency service. One of the first things he would do every morning would be to get the obituaries. He would go down, of course, he knew most of them, and he would call the family of whoever had passed away. Black, white, didn't make any difference to him. And he'd say, you know, this Senator Thurmond, just want you to know I'm with you. I'm thinking about you. I knew your husband, brother, wife, as a fine person, a very fine person. And he was diligent about that. And someone, you know, loses a loved one and gets a call from senior senator from South Carolina. And I can say it didn't make any difference who it was. He would call them and commiserate with them. And it's one reason why he didn't lose a single percentage, even though he was 94 years old and obviously well past his prime.
And getting back to this century, what about Marco Rubio's 2010 race? That's a race that starts off with at least the conventional wisdom assumption that Republican Governor Charlie Crist will waltz into an open Senate seat. By the end of the campaign, Charlie Crist is not only not in the U.S. Senate, but is no longer even in the Republican Party. Rubio comfortably wins a three-way race over Democrat Kendrick Meek. Crist is an independent. Can you give some flavor to how that 2010 race went down that propelled Marco Rubio onto the national scene in 2010, from which he remains a presence today?
Marco was and is a very gifted politician. You're right. Everyone assumed that Charlie Crist would win that Republican nomination in 2010. He famously took a picture with arms around Barack Obama. This was the rise of the Tea Party, and Marco became a candidate of the Tea Party movement. That picture with Charlie Crist and Barack Obama was absolute poison in a Republican primary in 2010. But Marco could, when he was on, just mesmerize people. There was one of his Democratic colleagues when he was in the state Senate had some line about the fact that when Marco Rubio starts talking, before you know it, the women are fainting and the toilets are flushing themselves. he just had that sort of effect once he started rolling. You're right. We not only beat Charlie Crist, we ran him out of the Republican Party. We would have won overwhelmingly had he stayed in, and he knew that, and the polling was pretty clear. But you're right. Marco ends up winning a three-way race fairly comfortably, and he was off to the races.
And speaking of Florida, you've been around Ron DeSantis, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but we're not intimately involved in the presidential campaign, but it's fashionable.
That's one way to put it.
It's fashionable now for people to pile on DeSantis after he started the 2024 presidential campaign with a lot of assets for a period, at least seeming as if he might even be the front runner. Then, as we know, the campaign lost altitude pretty quickly. He drops out right after Iowa. It's fashionable to pile on the campaign he ran or to say he just didn't have the right personality to go national. And I'm not saying it's inaccurate necessarily by any means, but you've seen him up close. What is your read on Ron DeSantis in general and whatever thoughts you have on what we've all witnessed over the last 12, 18 months with his presidential campaign?
We did his 2018 gubernatorial run. He is a very bright, very ambitious guy with a very, very good resume for Republican politics. In 2018, he ended up getting a Donald Trump endorsement, which was golden. He was running against Adam Putnam, agriculture commissioner, former congressman who had been running for governor of Florida since he was in diapers. And everybody just assumed that Adam would be the nominee. But we did a survey, and it was pretty clear what a Trump endorsement in 2018 would mean in the Republican primary. Ron was behind Adam by about 10 points, if memory serves. And we say, what if Donald Trump endorses Ron DeSantis? It was a 25-point swing. He went from 10 down to 15 up on the basis of Donald Trump's endorsement. So he ends up winning the primary very comfortably, had a very close race against Andrew Gillum, nip and tuck. Our last poll had it 47-47. Doesn't get a lot better in polling for a nip and tuck race. He ends up winning it after a lengthy delay to count all the absentee ballots by less than one percentage point. Normally, when you work with a candidate and you end up winning
And your numbers are
right
solid.
on, you would expect you would continue to work with that candidate. Ron DeSantis will have absolutely nothing to do with anyone associated with the team that won, helped him win that 2018 race. Not the pollster, not the campaign manager, not the fundraiser, not either one of the media firms, and not the general consultant, Susie Wiles, who is now running Donald Trump's campaign. It's a really unusual thing. I mean, sometimes, some people come and some people go, but normally you keep the core of people around you who've helped you win. I mean, Joe Biden has people who've been around him literally for decades, And to have nobody with that campaign continue on just seems a little curious, And he ends up with a team that had never gone through a tough race with him before. I mean, he won the re-election campaign going away, but he had a team that had never been with him before in a tough race, had never been through a war together. There's something about going through a campaign war and coming out on the other side with a victory that is a cementing experience for everybody involved, frankly, but especially the candidate and some of the key people who've helped him. And I guess Ron just figured that he did it all on his own. But he had a team that was relatively new. He ends up with this bizarre relationship with Super PAC, basically subcontracting much of the campaign to a Super PAC you can't talk to. And then he ends up making all kinds of, I think he had a fundamental misread of the Republican Party. I mean, in my judgment, it's about a third always Trump, only about 10% never Trump, but probably about 40% always Trump, 10% never Trump, and about 50% maybe Trump, people who voted for Trump twice, but are worried about his character, his ability to win, and would at least look at an alternative. That's the perspective that Nikki Haley has had, that her market is these people who voted for Trump twice, but were a little worried about him going forward, being able to beat Biden and that sort of thing, which is why she walked such a careful line. It seemed like Ron DeSantis was going after the always Trump people. We're going to start slitting throats on day one, or Ukraine is just a mere territorial dispute, or my favorite, he's going to think that RFK Jr., a vaccine denier, would be a really good candidate to run for the Centers for Disease Control. I mean, it was just a whole series of amateur mistakes that made him go down farther and farther. And it looked like he was trying to get the always Trump voters, and the always Trump voters are not going to settle for the second best Trump if they can get the real thing. So I thought it's a whole series of things, but it starts with a fundamental misread of the nature of the Republican electorate, coupled with a team that had never been with him before. He moved the campaign manager, last summer, I guess, to stick in somebody else, followed by a series of amateur mistakes that made him go from what was the lead, because there were a number of polls, including one of ours, that had him ahead, you know, in January of 2023, right after the midterms were disappointing for Republicans. And to go from that to not even making it past New Hampshire is not a good lesson in campaign management, let's put it that way.
And you've been around a lot of candidates. You're, three, four decades being around candidates at various different levels, including several people, Lamar Alexander, John McCain, among others who run for president, operated at the highest levels. Is it fair to say that DeSantis, just in terms of one-on-one, dealing with people, working the room, is cut from a different cloth, a less conventional cloth than most of the traditional backslapping retail, pale fellow, well-met politicians, or is that overstated?
I learned from Paul Coverdale. There are lots of different kinds of personalities that could be successful in politics. Paul was this mousy little man with his high, reedy voice, and he had this tendency to move his hands in front of his face when he was in a camera, and we were threatening to duct tape his hands to the podium so he couldn't do it anymore. But he was not the least bit hail fellow well met. He was mistaken often on the Capitol Hill for a staffer because he'd have all his briefing books under his arm and kind of hunched over and walking. So you don't have to be the hail fellow well met type to be successful in politics. But you do have to like people, and you do have to feel comfortable around people, and you do have to enjoy being around other people. And I'm not sure that describes Ron DeSantis very well. He seems stiff on the stump. He gave the impression that, you know, he would really rather be doing something else. You know, superb politicians, and Bill Clinton is the best example, have a unique ability for that 45 seconds he's talking to you to make you think that you're the most important person to him in the entire world. Good politicians have that, whether they're hail fellow well met or not. And Ron DeSantis just doesn't.
Is there a candidate or a campaign, prominent one or less prominent, but something we haven't touched on that you're especially proud of, or maybe speaks to the role that good polling can play in campaigns? A case study that you find yourself sharing, something we haven't touched on?
I think the Bill Frist 94 campaign is one of the more remarkable ones. Jim Sasser was chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. He was planning his ascension to be the majority leader.
Right. The Democratic majority leader was not running for re-election, George Mitchell. So the betting line was that Jim Sasser is going to be the next Democratic leader.
That's right. That's right. And nobody had ever really heard of Bill Frist, you know, I mean, outside the medical community anyway. His father had been physician to a lot of governors, but no one had ever heard of Bill Frist. I first met him in a hospital in Vanderbilt where he was working. He was at the time one of the world's leading heart lung transplant surgeons. And I met him. He came out in scrubs. He had some blood on his scrubs. And I think he was 41 years old at the time and said, I'm thinking about running for the Senate. And I looked at him and said, why the hell would you do a thing like that? You're one of the world's leading heart lung transplant surgeons. You're a god in your world. Your patients worship you. I don't know why you would leave that to go run for public office, particularly as a flaming underdog. He said, "Whit, transplanting hearts and lungs has just become a little bit mechanical. I've got a team that I've taught to do that, and I'm looking to make a difference somewhere else." Later, I discovered that Bill sort of thought of his life in 10, 12-year increments. You know, this 10-year increment, I'm going to become one of the world's leading heart-lung transplant surgeons. And this 10-year increment, I think I'll believe I'll be Republican majority leader in the U.S. Senate. And now he's gone off to do humanitarian work in Africa. But anyway, the first poll we did for him, I flew an airplane at that point, and I flew from Atlanta up to Nashville, and we were going to meet on a Sunday morning and arrive at his house, and he's not there. But where's Bill? His wife says, "Oh, he got called out to do a transplant last night." I thought, "Oh, really? Okay, well, fine. We'll We'll come back later. Said, no, he's on his way here. Later, I discovered that, late, about 11 o'clock that night, he'd gotten the call. Some poor kid had been killed in a motorcycle accident in East Tennessee, and his parents had been willing to donate his heart. So Bill had gotten in a jet, flown to East Tennessee, cut the kid's heart out, put it on ice, flew back to Nashville, went into the Vanderbilt Hospital and cut an old guy's heart out and sewn this new heart in, and then shows up at his house. And I'm like, wow, I would just want a beer and go to bed. And I said, we can come back later. He said, no, it's fine. For the next 3 hours, we sit there looking at cross tabs, details about, race, a potential opening. His attention never flagged. His eyes never closed. And I thought, this guy is some kind of a bionic man. But he decided he would run. He ended up winning a six-way primary. Bob Corker, later Republican senator, was part of that primary crowd. Then ends up running against Jim Sasser. People really didn't give him a chance in hell. But we were running a bunch of ads on TV. It helped that Bill was worth $25 million in his Hospital Corporation of America stock. Somebody asked the campaign manager after it was over, Bill's worth $25 million, isn't he? And the response was, not anymore, he's not. But we were running a bunch of ads, and we did a survey that showed Bill within 4 percentage points of Jim Sasser and put that out, and that got a lot of play. Rush Limbaugh picked it up and said, you guys really need to keep an eye on this place down in Tennessee. Something's happening. In that poll I mentioned, we had done a generic ballot test. You couldn't test just Bill Frist, who nobody heard of, against Jim Sasser. We described Sasser, we described Frist in fairly objective terms and asked who they were for. And by 50 to 40, the Bill Frist character was ahead of the Jim Sasser character. This was August of 1993. And I realized right then, 94 could be a really good year for Republicans. Bill ends up winning that race by 14 percentage points, just a little more than the generic ballot in August of 93. By November of 94, he wins by 14 percentage points, blows Jim Sasser away. And Jim Sasser never took him seriously until it was too late. And by that time, we had a head of steam, and it was off to the races. It was an amazing campaign to meet some guy who nobody had ever heard of in a hospital in the summer of 93, and then watch the trajectory of this campaign and go on and win what has got to be one of the major upsets in recent U.S. Senate history against the guy who was going to be majority leader of the U.S. Senate.
Well, that's some of the greatest hits of your career in the trenches and political races. But you also, at times, hearkening back perhaps to your academic credentials, but you authored books, you write articles about many things, including the future and the direction of the Republican Party over the years, something you've put a lot of thought into. Let me tax your perspective on that, and not asking you to make even value judgments necessarily, but over the last decade or so, we've increasingly seen Republican voters rebel against the party establishment. The Tea Party 2010 election is maybe not the very first, but is an early sign of that, certainly the Trump era. And usually the conversation is about what Trump and his ilk have done to cultivate that rebellion. But it's really been pretty consistent story cycle over cycle for a while now. What missteps, what mistakes, with some hindsight, do you think that the Republican establishment made? What were they missing that indeed led to being a fertile ground for this insurgency we've seen within the Republican Party over the last 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, first of all, Zach, there have been populist politicians throughout American history. You had William Jennings Bryan back in the 1890s running as a Democrat, who as a populist. Had Huey Long, Democratic senator from Louisiana, who was very much of a populist. Had George Wallace in the 1960s, from Alabama, running as a populist. You even had Pat Buchanan in the 1992 convention giving a rip-roaring populist speech. Basically, populism is the good ordinary people against the corrupt elites. and the corrupt elites have really taken advantage of you. It has been a very difficult run for the Reagan-Bush Republican Party. We had never had a populist elected president before Donald Trump in 2016, but he truly did run as a populist against these coastal elites, tapped into a lot of resentment of folks, particularly in the heartland, blue-collar voters in particular. A lot of the changes that happened in the global economy really created the fertile ground for Donald Trump. I did some focus groups in 2017 in Pittsburgh with a bunch of blue-collar guys. And I was saying, you know, why are you for Trump? Why did you vote for Trump? And they said, listen, we look out at our community, all of the manufacturing jobs are gone. They've all moved overseas. You know, we can have some service jobs come in, but, you know, serving coffee at Starbucks doesn't pay what building a truck in a General Motors plant will pay. We've got opioids that are ripping our community apart, ripping our families apart. We've got all these people addicted to opioids. And we get the fact that Donald Trump is kind of a jerk and that Donald Trump is a bear to work for. But we look out at what's happened to our communities, and our choice was between a guy who said he'd help us and a woman who called us deplorable. What the hell did you expect us to do? And some of that is a legacy of the 2008 financial meltdown, where Republicans did what they, I think, needed to do, certainly what they felt they needed to do in bail out the banks so that the financial system wouldn't collapse. But that was widely perceived by a great many Republicans as helping the guys who'd caused the collapse at the expense of those who suffered as a result of the collapse. And that created some real anger, some real resentment, and some real animosity toward the elites, the people who run things. That is what that Donald Trump has tapped into and has fed his political movement. Now, Donald Trump has never had majority of the people behind him. He's never gotten a majority of the popular vote. He never had a majority of people who approved of his job performance. But he has developed a very, very committed group of people who will walk through a wall of flame for him. The problem with populism is that it tends to be anti. It tends to be anti-intellectual, anti-expertise, anti-immigrant, anti-media, anti-establishment. It has a hard time creating a positive agenda. Brexit in England is a classic example of it. You know, well, this European Union is a pain. We just need to get out of it. Well, how are we going to solve this problem? How are we going to deal with the Northern Ireland border? Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out later. And so they pass Brexit. And what are we now, 7 years later? They're still trying to figure it out. And that's the challenge of populism, is having a forward-looking positive agenda. But there is no question that Donald Trump has developed a very powerful, committed base of supporters that will walk through a wall of flame for him. I've said many times, criticizing Donald Trump among always Trump voters is like criticizing Jesus in a rural evangelical church. You know, you can stand up and say Jesus is not all he's cracked up to be. It's not going to have any effect on Jesus's reputation, but it'll sure destroy the reputation of the person who took a shot at him. And that's exactly what's happened with people who've taken shots at Donald Trump. Chris Christie ran a pretty tough, hard campaign. Problem is that in the Republican Party these days, the Never Trump crowd's about 10%, 12%. And Christie reached that ceiling and couldn't go any farther because he was coming after Donald Trump in a way that most Republicans weren't going to hear about.
Well, as we wind down, let me ask your thoughts on the polling industry writ large. Over the years, what have you seen that really separates the really effective, strong, smart pollster from the rest of the pack? What is an X factor or two that you've seen?
Well, really good pollsters really understand the methodology, first of all. They are very careful about structuring samples so that they match what we know to be, or what we at least think to be, the likely electorate. They don't cut corners. They don't do things cheaply. they don't do a punch one if Biden, punch two if Trump kind of survey on your cell phone and then put that out as though it's worth something. Good polling's expensive. Good polling takes time. Good polling cannot be done on the cheap. And there are a lot of folks out there who buy a personal computer and announce that they're pollsters. I mentioned that I started my career back when we had mainframes. Mainframes were really expensive. There were huge barriers to entry in the polling business back when I first started. There are almost no barriers to entry now. You can get an online panel and you can do a quick poll and put it out. And some of them are pretty good and some of them are utter garbage. I think getting someone who is really serious about their methodology, really careful with how they structure their samples, and really, really committed to not cutting corners is the difference between really first-rate pollsters. And there are many on both sides now. You work for a very fine firm on the Democratic side, and I work for a pretty darn good one on the Republican side. But the similarity in methodology is frequently very, very close. It's why when there are panels of Republican and Democratic pollsters, people come expecting cable food fight. And it frequently is not because we're looking at the same data. We may have a different perspective on the data, but we're all looking at the same data. And that kind of keeps us reasonably close to the same worldview in a way that it doesn't if you really don't care about data and all you want to do is spout off on some opinion you've got.
Well, let me end on this. And this came up briefly earlier. What is the story of how you start and operate a successful political consulting business, conduct hundreds of polls a year, and still find time to get your pilot license and spend what I assume must be hundreds of hours in the air each year as well? What is the story of Pilot Whit Ayers?
I have always loved aviation. I remember as a sixth grader doing a bulletin board on the Bernoulli principle and how airplanes fly. And when I was on the faculty at University of South Carolina, they had a flying club and I decided, well, it was time to learn to fly, which I did. And I flew safely for 35 years at a Mooney and then a Beechcraft Baron, 4,000 hours before I finally hung it up. I now live across the street from Washington Reagan National Airport, and I had to keep my airplane way out in Leesburg because of after 9/11, it was really tough to fly around the Washington, D.C. area. So I eventually decided I wasn't flying enough to be safe. I think you need to fly at least 100 and better 200 hours a year in order to fly safely. And so I decided it was time to put that part of my life in the past, but I really enjoyed flying. I enjoyed aviation. It's really, really important to do things right. You keep your little plane on that little black line and everything will be fine and you kill yourself. So it's a real incentive to try to do things well and do things right. And it's something I've carried over into almost everything else I've done in life.
Well, I couldn't have enjoyed this more, a great walk through the politics of the last 40 years with one of the most successful Republican pollsters of his generation, Whit Ayers. Thanks so much for your time today.
Zach, appreciate the opportunity. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.